Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Hey listeners, I'm back again, and today we return to the British triathlon legends, and I've got an absolute legend on the show today. It's taken me a while to get hold of him, but I'm really pleased that to welcome Richard Hobson onto the show. Hello, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Now, you're based out in France now, aren't you? So what's the weather like at this time of year for you?
Well, it's sunny now, but it's not much different to the UK, to be fair, at this time of year. Maybe a little bit milder, but not too much different.
Okay.
The summer's a lot nicer, though, so we'll take that.
Yeah, and you're living right in the middle of the wine and the cheese country, aren't you? So you've probably just got a slightly different lifestyle to what you might have in the UK.
Yeah, we're in the kind of Bordeaux cognac-y kind of area of stuff. So, yeah, there's a bit going on if you like your wine and cognac.
Well, we'll get some more details about where you're based and what you're doing down there, Richard. But what I've started to do recently, and as you know, a good coach, we've always got to have a warm up before we get onto the main stuff. So I sent you some questions to so you weren't put on the spot. Now, most of the listeners are the same age as you and I, and I think we probably are about the same age, although you look like you've worn a little better than I have. But we've still both got a full head of hair, haven't we?
Yeah, we're not bad. And I do wear glasses, but I just haven't got them on just to make you feel better.
It's only because I have to read these questions and I want to be able to see what I've written that I need to keep mine on. Okay. Anyway, so these are the quick fire questions. So these are from our era. So if we've got any younger listeners listening, you'll have to go and Google all of this stuff. So when you were growing up, Rich, was it Blue Peter or Magpie?
Yeah, Blue Peter.
Yeah, sure. Good. BBC. Probably as you were growing up, but still continuing today. Pepsi or Coke?
Coke, I'm afraid to say. Yeah,
I've always been a Coke man. How about in your pre-race days, pizza or pasta?
Pizza still is.
Yeah, me
still
too.
Is my favourite.
Although not every day now. Pizza Friday for me. So you've been around, being the same age as me, were you punk or new romantic?
New romantic.
Yeah, I thought you might be. Yeah, the hairstyle. What about
baggy trousers?
Yeah. Now these guys were still rocking it back then. Now they're having to do the final films, aren't they? Stallone or Arnie?
Yeah, it's a close one that, but I think Stallone because I did like the Rocky kind of era of things.
I watched his Rambo Last Blood the other week. You know, it's almost like the final curtain for him. His face has seen a bit of work, hasn't it?
They're both of them a bit worse to wear than us, I think.
Yeah. Okay. What about sports kit then? There weren't many in our day. Puma or Adidas?
Again, a close one, but I'll go Puma.
Oh.
For a short time I had Puma sponsorship, so I'll say that back in the day.
Okay. Good for you. All right, now these ones require a little bit more thought and maybe slightly longer answers. We know you were a super athlete in your day, Rich, but if you could have one of those Marvel-style superpowers, which one would you choose to have?
I think to fly, I decided.
Yeah, wow.
Is that one of them? I don't know.
Well, you can't do that as a human, can you? So I guess if we could fly, you'd have to be fairly superhuman.
That would be pretty good.
I was saying to another guest, though, that we think it would be great to have these superpowers. You know, quite a few people choose invisibility or the ability to think, you know, to get inside people's heads and know what everybody's thinking. But I bet that there's got to be some downsides to having superpowers as well, surely.
Well, I'm sure there is to some, but I don't think there's a downside to if you can fly. It would save a fortune.
You would.
Oh, dear.
Okay, let's do a couple of fun ones then. So a cartoon character who most resembles you. So if you were struggling with this one, I'll give you a bit of a running start here. I used to take my washing around to this laundrette around the corner, and the girl in there used to think I was like Digger because I was always dashing between here and there.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone who I resemble as a cartoon character. Anyone come to your mind? I mean,
well, whenever you used to go past me on the second lap when I was still on the first of my bike, it was like the Tasmanian devil going past. There was a whirl of dust, and in there somewhere was Richard Hobson, but you couldn't quite see him.
Oh, well, that would be a good one. Yeah, I like that. That'll do. We'll take that one.
Okay, Tasmanian devil. What about a signature song? I don't know. Do you do any presentations? And you know how they put a walk on tune. Do you have anything there that you'd choose?
No, I've never done anything. That's like the darts, isn't it? When they come to a like rocking to some tune, I've got no idea what I would choose for that. God, signature tune. Yeah, my wife's acting Rocky. That's my ringtone at the moment. The Rocky tune, but a bit too common, isn't it? I'd have thought.
You've been to Kona, haven't you? And did you ever go to the awards ceremony when you were there?
Yeah, normally been to the awards.
Mike Riley has his walk-on tune. It's the Who, you know, Bubba Riley type thing. But and he walks on pointing to everybody. I don't know if you ever read his book, but that whole pointing thing became a bit of a whole load of people's jokes because they used to have bets on how many people he would point at, and they'd have a sweepstake running. But that, you know, that's the sort of thing we're talking about.
Is that what he always came on to? No, I'll have to work on a walk-on theme when I next have the opportunity, which I don't know when that will be.
Well, you must when you do your training camps in Lanzarote, there must be the time when they're all gathered on the first day when you explain to them what you do. You could try that out. You could get your wife to put it on, and then you could make an entrance to the side of the room and see how it goes down.
I'll try to think of I don't think it'll be Rocky though. I think that would be a bit cheesy, but I'll work on something. I'll work on that. If that's the end thing to do now, and it's going to go down well with the punters, then I'll work on that.
Well, maybe you'll have to think about something about flying. You could combine your superpower with your walk-on music.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the tune that's standing out in my head is what's in the Pretenders or the Claimers, what, you know, that I've walked whatever. So that's not really flying, but I've walked 500 miles and, always like that song. That was quite
funny. Oh, well, that might be a good start. You'd have to beta test. See what sort of responses you get at your camps.
I'm not sure. I think if my kids are in there, they will probably leave the room of embarrassment.
Well, why don't you should let them choose one for you.
Yeah, okay. Well, they chose my ringtone, to be fair.
All right, well, that's a bit cheesy, so maybe they sound like they've been sacked already.
Yeah. It'll either be heavy metal, because one of my sons is into that, or, I don't know what the other one would be.
All right. Well, let's go on to something a little easier to answer then. So I know you're a busy lad. You've got your training, you've got your coaching, you've got your sort of like your family there, but do you get much time to read at all?
Yeah, I do. I never used to actually when I was growing up, but I read, only at night time now. Every night, like to read. I'm a real slow reader. But hey.
Do you, what was the last
book?
What was the last book?
There you go. Can you see that?
I can see that. Jeffrey Archer.
Heads You Win.
Oh, no, I don't think I've read that one.
Quite good. Apart from, I'm not quite sure what the finish, I couldn't quite understand it, which is a bit strange. But hey, it's a good book, though.
Oh, these days, you can probably go on Google and somebody will have, there'll have been a great big long thread about how to interpret the finish.
Yeah, well, maybe that's what I should do because I was a bit confused.
Is that your favourite book, or do you have one book that really stands out as being your favourite one you've ever read?
No, it's. I think I haven't so much got a favourite book, but I do enjoy the Jack Reacher series, the Lee Child. There's a whole load of those now. So probably the first one I ever read of those, which I can't remember what that was probably, that stood out the most because it was a Yeah, I quite enjoy those as easy reading.
I'd never read any of the Jack Reacher books. I've seen a couple of the films with Tom Cruise in, and then I read one book about where Jack Reacher had to go and rescue some kids that had been kidnapped and were taken into the forest by some guys as part of some bizarre sort of hunting game.
Oh, yeah, but I've read that one.
Yeah, but what most stood out to me in that was that Jack Reacher was described as being 6'5" and very muscular and rangy. And I was thinking, well, why did they get Tom Cruise to play in there? Because Tom Cruise in 6'5", and about a week after I'd finished the book, I saw in the papers that they were Lee Child had said that they needed to find a Jack Reacher actor that would actually portray the person that he writes about.
Yeah, I mean, that was the biggest joke ever, the fact that he played that. I mean, he's small and, yeah, I mean, it was just ridiculous. I think it was because he directs the movie, doesn't he?
Oh, but I don't know.
Yeah, but it's completely out of character. I mean, it's, you know, it's ridiculous. I don't know how that ever happened.
Maybe I was recalling now that there was something to do with Netflix or Amazon had taken over the ownership of the rights now, and so that they were able to change who the lead actor would be.
Oh, well, maybe that'd be good. But they need to find somebody kind of, yeah, just
The Rock.
Tall and rough looking.
The Rock.
Yeah, a little bit like that, but he's probably a bit too big. He needs to be more kind of sinewy and lean and a bit like me, really.
Yeah, but a bit. You're not 6'5", Richard, are you? With the best will in the world.
Yeah, well, then, you know, it's what they can do with standing on a platform and nobody would know.
No. You've been to some great places, like we all have, as sort of racing and sort of, you know, getting into the triathlon tourism bit. And you've done some great things. Are there any things on your bucket list that you haven't done yet, or places you want to go?
You know, not so much. I mean, I've never been to New Zealand, which is
neither have I. So
yeah, and it's a long way away. I mean, there's a lot of places I haven't been to, and I'm not fussed about, you know, kind of so many places. But New Zealand would be nice. Yeah, I think that's the only one that stands out when I saw the question that I would like to go to at some stage.
Okay. What about races? I know you're still racing occasionally. Have you got any races you'd still like to do?
I don't know if it still exists. It's one I never got to do, and that was St. Croix. I would like to have done that, but I don't know if it actually still goes on anymore. I would have quite liked to have done that.
That was one of those early season half Ironman races, wasn't it? Because it was obviously in the Caribbean, so a nice place to go there before the summer.
And it had the beast in it, didn't it? Some really steep section of road that people had to ride up.
Although I did find out a girl that I was coaching went to do it, and she said it's not like any of the hills in Yorkshire, really, or probably some of the hills you might have ridden down on the moors in Devon.
And that's probably true, actually, because those are like 25 to 30%, aren't they? I remember those. Down on Dartmoor, so maybe.
So
but it always looked like a nice race.
Yeah. There's this new Patagonia man that's come out. They've just had the second edition of it now.
That really
tickles my fancy, just because it's in an amazing part of the world, and I quite like those point to point races that require you to think a bit about your logistics and your support crew a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, all of those, I mean, I think they sound amazing. The thing that really puts me off, and it's a bit like the Norseman, is the cold. I mean, Patagonia, man. I mean, I think the water temperature was 8 degrees this year. I mean, I know someone who did it. And I know someone who, because actually, yeah, I know, I mean, Charlie Pendleton did it, and Stuart Anderson supported him. So that's cold. And then he was cold for a long time on the bike, you know, just actually couldn't even change his gears and stuff. And so, that's the problem with those. And Norseman, the same, isn't it? I mean, it looks amazing, but if it rains the whole time, it's just not going to be much fun.
Yeah, I've done the Norseman, and I don't recall the fjord being that cold. I mean, it was 15 or 16 degrees, but that's the sort of thing that you can warm up into and get used to.
Not like that's okay to swim in.
Yeah, 8 degrees. I was out in the Isle of Man earlier this, in May last year, and we went swimming at Port Erin, and it was 11 degrees there, and 15 minutes was enough. So
yeah, I mean, it's not nice to swim like that. Even you've got gloves and boots and
Charlie was a Marines officer, wasn't he? So he's used to being in the water and getting cold as well. So if people like Charlie struggle to deal with it.
Yeah, I know, but I think he's got something. He has a kind of reaction to the cold, which makes it. I can't remember what it is he has now, but I think that makes it particularly difficult for him. So not ideal, but he got through.
You were pretty much a full time athlete in your younger years, and then you went to France and you're running this training camp there. But you know, if you'd had to have a proper job, Richard, what would it have been?
The job. I mean, I qualified as a teacher. And if that's a proper job, that's probably what put me off ever having a proper job. I don't know if I can't think of what I would do if as a proper job. And I don't, what is a proper job? It's like,
well, I think in the traditional sense of the word, when
sit down.
You work sort of reasonable hours. You have weekends off. You know, you don't have too much fun while you're doing it.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think what I'd do, really. I guess, maybe, I would have done something like teaching, because I was always a bit lazy and always needed to know there's going to be extra holiday, I suppose. I don't know. But you just kind of fall into things, don't you, which you then keep doing. And I guess I've been quite lucky, really. I kind of had a proper job when I worked for the Bath University and then for the BTA, but it's still not really. It was never a 9-to-5, and it was never a, weekends free or anything like that.
I'd forgotten about that, Richard. I'm glad you reminded me about the Bath University days, because that's quite integral as the history of British triathlon. And I'll put a caveat in here as well to all those teachers who are listening. Richard and I don't really think that it's not a proper job. We respect everything you do. So please don't be flooding us with Facebook comments and emails complaining that we don't appreciate you. We do, honestly.
Yeah.
Don't we, Richard?
Of course it's a proper job. It's a very, very important job.
So let's dive into your life and your career then now, Rich. So when you were growing up, were you quite an active boy, and what were your main sporting interests before you got into triathlon?
I played tennis badly as a kid. But I mean, I think the thing that's quite interesting and something that I've always kept at the back of my mind the whole time I've gone through kind of my career is I wasn't really into sport when I was young. Right up into secondary school, the only sports in school we were doing was traditional football, cricket. I was rubbish at both of those, so my interest in sport was zil, really. And it was only when I got into windsurfing, which I got into probably when I was about 14. And that just kind of opened up a lot of new doors and excitement, and I kind of discovered sport. And I look at that and I realize, if people don't get the chance to try something that they actually enjoy within sport, then of course they're never going to get into sport. And it is weird to think at the time that I went from not being sporty, I'd say definitely not being sporty, to actually becoming a full-time athlete. I mean, it's quite strange that I'd never have ever predicted, when I was like 14, 15, that could have happened. So windsurfing kind of led on, to quite a high level. I actually did Olympic trials. I can't even think what Olympics that was for. I think for Sydney. No, or was it? No, it must have been before then. Did Olympic trials, but again, only one person went. And then soon after that was when I went to university, and then I kind of wound down a little bit after that.
Yeah, I remember So I had it in the back of my mind that you'd come from windsurfing into triathlon. And I remember even back then thinking, wow, how does he get to be so good at swimming, biking and running if he's been standing on a board out in the sea? You know, you're trying not to fall off and swim there, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's the funny thing, because when I went to university, which was, I guess I was 19 or 20, I'm rubbish at remembering exactly dates, you know, I hadn't swum, biked or ran more than just biking to the shop or jogging or, you know, so I really had come from none of the sports. And I got into them all pretty much at the same time when I started university. And, you know, you kind of joined every club going, joined the swim club, you know, started biking to university and stuff, and joined the athletics club or the cross country club, actually. Yeah, and that's kind of how it started. Yeah, it's quite funny thinking back. That's how it was.
So, what was the first triathlon that you did then?
The first one I did, and it wasn't exactly a triathlon. It had kayaking in it as well, and it was actually run at the college I was at, or the university, which is the Marjohns in Plymouth, and it was organised by one of the lecturers who he'd actually done the coast to coast in New Zealand. This guy. So I was already starting to get a bit interested in triathlon. And I think I'd seen, you know, kind of seen Hawaii clips and things like that. But anyway, so he had done that. And then he put on a race, or organized one at the uni, where we swam, I can't remember, 400 meters in the pool. Then we had to run out to where our bike was, which was about a kilometer and a half away, bike over Dartmoor a little bit, kind of towards Yelverton and back, out finishing at a place called Burrettor Reservoir. It's kind of on the edge of Dartmoor near Yelverton. Kayaked in Burrettor Reservoir, so a lap around the reservoir, back on your bike, and then ending up with a run back into the university. So that was the first one. I think I finished fourth or something. Can't remember. There was a local. I remember a guy called Terry Leonard. He was a fairly good triathlete back in that day as well. He won. And that's kind of how I got started. That was the first one.
And how old was that when you were at university then?
Yeah, so that was probably my second year there. So I was probably 21 or 22, because I'd missed a couple of years before I went to university.
So you were born in 19, were you born in 64 like me?
65. Oh, you're older than me.
Oh, only a bit. So 65, so that would have been 87, 88 then?
Yeah, that'd be about right.
Okay, yeah. And then when was your first proper triathlon then, swim, bike and run?
I think that was the only race I did that year. And then the following year, I started properly doing races. I can't remember what the first ones were. I used to just go to all those early races, you know, but like the Swindons and they just go up, get on a train with my bike and go, and you know, I used to sleep in the tents and stuff, you know, of these races. It was funny. I think Swindon was the first race, because I know one of your questions was one of the first races that I felt was like a real breakthrough race. So I think like 1 year I came like just outside the top 20. And then I think the next year I went and won it, and almost completely surprised myself that happened. And that was kind of the first time I realized, you know, that I was kind of had improved quite a lot. And actually it was the first time I realized I could actually bike really fast compared to other people. So I don't know. That was kind of a real turning point, I think.
What year was that when you won in Swindon, Richard?
Oh, you see, I tell you, I'm rubbish on dates. I've got no idea.
Can you remember who you were racing against? I've got a feeling you'd have been racing against Robin Brew, maybe.
I've got a feeling Robin was at the side of the road holding his bike in two bits. but I can't remember if that was the year I won it or the year before. He was on this low profile bike, you know, with a tiny front wheel and a normal size back wheel. I just remember passing him, and he had like two bits of a bike in his hands. So it was definitely, yeah, around that time. I remember Ken McLaren was like second or third the year I won it. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if we go to look back at what dates those were. I'm rubbish at remembering.
I could probably go back and find some, because I used to come down to, it was at the Cotswold Water Park area, wasn't it, the Swindon Triathlon?
Yeah, and it used to move the parks a little bit, but it was always there, yeah.
Sponsored by Total Fitness, Trevor Gunning.
Yeah, exactly.
Were Total Fitness Swindon or Total Fitness Bath one of your sponsors at some point?
Total Fitness Swindon, I mean, and that was Trevor, Trevor and Jan. I mean, Total Fitness Swindon was really where Total Fitness started, wasn't it? And Trevor and Jan were the founders, really. And then they went off to set up Bath and Nottingham, and then I think they got sold off separately or whatever. But yeah, that was, so I was sponsored by Swindon, and that was with Trevor, and they were a big kind of help and influence in my early days. I mean, they were kind of good sponsors and looked after me, and I stayed with them a lot. And I think Trevor used to just give me everything I wanted in the shop, and then Jan used to take it back because she was the one more controlling, and I think they would have gone bust rather quickly if it hadn't been for Jan there. But that was good.
What back in those days then, Richard, what sort of kit were you using?
I think the first ever wetsuit I had was called Triathlon Pro. It had big long zips down the front, and I think even you could take the whole front panel out. But I think that was a Plymouth-based company.
Can't remember. I remember Snuggle quite big back then. Were you sponsored by Snuggle at one point?
Yeah, I still am.
Right.
Still the best suits.
Yeah, well, that's good.
There you go. Yeah, no, I really believe that. I was sponsored by Snuggle fairly early on, but I don't know when they started making triathlon suits. I went through a few different, and I have been through a lot of different types of wetsuit.
You were always well known. You mentioned biking fast and everybody else, Rich, and I'm going to come on to the whole Captain Quads nickname in a minute, but you definitely blasted your way through. If you weren't first out the swim, you were always there or thereabouts, but you seemed to blast your way through the field on the bike and leave everybody trailing in your wakes. And so therefore, people would always have been influenced by the sort of bike you were riding. What was it back then?
I mean, my first ever bike that I remember, which I bought secondhand from somewhere. I mean, Colin Lewis used to look after me. That was a bike shop down in close to where I lived in Torquay. And he used to look after me. And my first proper bike, but it wasn't really a triathlon bike, but it was a Vitus, one of those Drelinox, was it called, or something like shiny silver bike, lovely bike. So that was the first bike that I remember standing out, and I ended up putting, aero, whatever, thingy bars onto it. And then I guess my first bike sponsor, good bike sponsor, was Trek. So I had that for quite a few years. They were, really nice bikes. Principia, I was sponsored by.
Principia, yeah.
Yes, I still got one of those. My son is still riding one of my Principias that I raced on. Still a nice TT bike, which I mean, it's had a few updates. And then I think with Total Fitness, I also was sponsored by Giant for a while. So I had that, the funny Giant. I can remember that monocoque Giant bike.
I do remember that one, because Richard Allen was also sponsored by Giant and had one.
And that's right.
The guy that we were chatting about pre-show, that had the training camp in Spain, bought that bike off Richard and still has it to this day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Well, it was funny because last year somebody was trying to organise this Race of Legends. I don't know if you saw that, which was a Race of Legends organised by, it was going to be in France, and it was actually, he'd planned to get, a lot of the guys, Mark Allen and all those guys were supposed to be coming, but it all fell through in the end. But I had managed to source the last one of those Giant bikes that I had, because I remembered who I sold it to, which was actually what's the name of the guy who lives in Lanzarote? Steve Bayliss, his brother.
Oh yeah,
bought the bike from me, so he was going to lend it back to me, to do this race on, because that's what the idea was. But the race never happened in the end, so it's like a real shame.
Mark Bayliss, I think, isn't it?
Is it Mark?
Mark was the guy who set it. He had the record for the Enduro Man, you know, the run to Dover, swim the Channel, and cycle to Paris. He held that record at one point.
That's bonkers. I've done that in a team, and it's bonkers that people do that on their own. It was hard enough in a team.
I've swum the Channel in a team, and that's bad enough.
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky. We had it good the day we swam the Channel, but it still makes you, you know, I know the weather plays a big part and things like that, but I mean, we were in wetsuits. I swim in the Channel without a wetsuit. There's no way I could ever do that.
Yeah, we did a Channel relay, six of us, full Channel swimming rules, you know, speedos only, or no, we weren't, because you're doing a relay and you're climbing on off the boat, you're not allowed any goose fat or any grease like that. You have to do a very strict hour. You have to dive in and swim past the person. You're not allowed to touch them. You know, it's very, very strict. You have to have an observer all the way through. We did actually have the fastest relay time of the year. In fact, since we did ours, nobody's beaten our relay time of 8:55. We ended up going to the Channel Swimming Awards for the year, and we all got a
But even an hour without a wetsuit in that, I mean, that would do me in, that would. I mean, that would be like, I mean, that's cold, isn't it? I mean,
well, it was 16 or 17 degrees, which is exactly what we were talking about, was the temperature when I did the Norseman. Yeah. And you know, I felt just about right in that, in a wetsuit. So an hour in that is definitely a challenge. I certainly wouldn't like to try and swim the whole of the Channel without a wetsuit, and I'd have to sort of lard up a little bit, I think. Significant.
Well, actually, though, but if you did it in 8 hours, that means that some people only had to swim once. That's not too bad.
Yes, I was one of them, actually. It was 8:55.
Yeah, there we go.
The three remaining people in the team, Philippa, myself and Fiona, we didn't get to swim a second time, and we really wanted to, but didn't want to be out there for 12 hours. half of our team was violently seasick, so... Anyway, it was good fun. It's amazing. Yeah. I like a lot of those things, you know, when you're doing a race and you're just wondering why you ever bothered entered. When you look back on it, you think, actually, that wasn't too bad, really.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So you progressed through the ranks quite quickly, Richard. You mentioned there that you didn't really start formally swim, bike or run training till you got to university. What was your training like back in those days then?
What, back at university?
Yeah, when you first started. Because we didn't, you know, back in the late 80s and early 90s, there weren't really any triathlon coaches as such. I mean, you know, the people we think of now as the forerunners of that, Steve True and Bill Black, hadn't really started coaching there. I don't think even Mark Allen or Dave Scott had written their books. So there was no real guidance or, you know, trailblazers to even give you some tips on how to train, really.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the funny thing is, you know, I went into university, was 4 years. I went into university having not done anything to do with triathlon. And then when I left university, I came out as a full-time triathlete kind of thing. So it was only a four-year turnaround. And so, you know, initially, yeah, there weren't really any coaches that kind of influenced me in any way, because it was just like university sessions. But then the people who do stand out, I mentioned like Colin Lewis was somebody who really stood out. I mean, he's still biking now. I mean, I talked to his, I don't know, Tamsin Lewis's daughter, who's a, you know, good athlete. He's still biking now. And I mean, I thought he was old then when I used to bike with him. And he's still out biking. You know, he's a hardcore. He was a ex-Tour de France rider who rode in the era of Tommy Simpson and stuff like that, rode on the same team, I think. So he was just a no-nonsense, hardcore biker, and he was a great person to ride with. And then other people were like Archie Boo and Robin. I actually spent time at Kelly College swimming after I left uni. To try to get my swimming better. So I actually spent time, you know, with help from those guys. Running wise, I can't think, but you know, I guess in some ways I was lucky because I had people like Glenn who lived very close to where I lived. So we used to train a lot together, and Glenn, you know, was already winning quite a lot and had come probably from a more athletic background. So I did a lot of my training with him. So he was a big influence. And then actually we had one other guy, Mark Malabini. Remember Mark Malabini?
Yeah, so I do. Yeah.
You know, he came over and was living in the same town as well, down in Torquay. You know, I did a lot of training with him. And so I think it was more kind of athletes that we were influenced by. And then people like Colin and Archie, you know, definitely had a big part.
Glenn and Sarah went across to America for a time, didn't they? Place themselves in San Diego. Did that ever cross your mind to go out there?
I went with them once, actually. So literally the first ever winter training camp I went on was with Glenn and Sarah. We went to Zimbabwe, and that was actually organized by Mark Malabini. Hmm. So we had we went to Zimbabwe, which is fantastic for the winter. And then the following year, we went to San Diego, and that was again with Glenn and Sarah. And it was, you know, they'd been doing that quite a few times. And so, you know, I was kind of just tagging on to what they were doing. Yeah, they showed the ropes, really.
Nice place to live, San Diego, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was nice to be there. I mean, I don't think it's such a popular training place now, is it? I mean, people tend to, you know, they've gone to Colorado and you don't really hear people going there. But it was fun to be there. You know, it's just kind of a fun existence. You know, you're training hard, but it was a lot of just chilling out and going out for breakfast, you know, like the Americans do, and things like that, which is drinking lots of coffee, which we still do a lot of. So.
Yeah, it's no wonder that either of us have ever wanted to have a proper job, really, is it? Because long breakfasts and coffee things are out, really, when you've got to be at work for 8:30.
Yeah, no, that's true. I like that. I like the relaxing part. I'm quite good at that.
As you progressed through your triathlon career, then did you take a more formalised approach to training, or was it very much on a sort of just by feel?
Yeah, I mean, it was very much by feel. I mean, you know, so any training plan I was writing myself, you know, so you know, I was having input from other people, but I was never having any kind of training plan written from anyone else. But I think you just learned the things that worked for you and that didn't work for you. And of course, those constantly changed as well. So sometimes things did work and then the next time they didn't seem to. I mean, some people, if you talk to people like Robin, they'll always say that I was very good. I mean, I'd call it almost being lazy, but you know, I was very good at knowing when doing more wasn't going to be good for me. Whereas people like Robin are very good at pushing way beyond what's good for them. There you go, Robin. If you ever get to hear this, he knows it. I think I was quite sensible. And maybe a little bit lazy. I don't know. It's hard to know, but I've definitely managed to keep going a long time, which is quite nice. And you know, I've got no injuries. You know, I'm well, which is quite nice, really.
Yeah, I mean, you're still going now, which is testament to the way you've looked after yourself. And I seem to, unless my memory's sort of playing tricks on me, I don't recall you really ever having to miss large periods of time through sort of prolonged injury.
No, I've never had anything more than my worst injury I ever had was a sprained ankle that I sustained falling off the pavement on New Year's Eve. So, and that's what, you know, the fact that stands out as my worst injury, and I can't remember what new year that was. So I have been lucky, but you know, obviously I've had twinges, and I have probably more times now that I have to be a little bit more careful and, you know, stiff and feel things are twinging a little bit, but generally I've been pretty lucky.
I do wonder whether there's anything in that to do with this sort of not having that sporting background as a youngster. I've seen somebody, I can't remember who it was, wrote about that. They said, if you want to perform well as an older athlete, you need to have not had much of a younger career. There's a friend of mine who's won his age group in Hawaii at the age of 72. He didn't really get started in sport or triathlon until his late 40s when he gave up smoking and wanted to lose some weight. So his 30-year career has been at the latter part of his life, whereas a lot of people have had it at the early start stage. But then what they did as a youngster seems to catch up with them at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's true. But I also, you know, I look at age, some of the top age groupers now, you know, like in my age group and the older age groups, it's like what you're saying, you know, it's almost like they're not damaged goods in a way, and they're actually performing better and getting better performances than people like myself who, you know, have been doing it so many years. And it is quite an interesting one. It does make me think, you know, is it always healthy? You know, obviously I've got two kids coming up through the sport, and they started from, you know, ground zero, like when they were 3 years old, they've started doing triathlon, and you know, it does make me think, you know, got to keep the balance, so I have to keep it healthy. You don't want it to be detrimental when they get older.
Do you remember what you mentioned Swindon there? Was that your first big win?
I think it must be, because it stands out. You know, I don't know how big, you know, Swindon was really. I mean, it was always a fairly big race, and there's some quite good people won it over the years. So I guess it was, yeah. I mean, the races that always stand out were obviously the Iron Bridge, you know, which used to be often the half Ironman championships. And I think they were probably that series of half Ironman wins that I got from Iron Bridge, I think would probably stand out as my best, you know, kind of my best wins, and probably my favourite event as well, that Iron Bridge event.
There'll be a few of the old school triathletes listening now be nodding their head at that one. I used to like Iron Bridge, although it always seemed like I got some sort of stomach bug afterwards from swimming past that. You know, when you used to go through, you'd have to walk up the river, and it was a point-to-point river swim. Then you'd have to go through the narrows and the shallows, where you'd often have to, if you didn't get the right line, you have to walk through. And then you got into the real current, where if you weren't careful, you ended up going past the bridge and the steps to get out. But that bit going past the power station, the water always seemed about 3 or 4 degrees warmer, and it always sticks in my mind that I remember swimming past there and thinking, with all this warm water, I wouldn't be surprised if I saw fishes with two heads or something there.
Yeah, it wouldn't, yeah. The water was so murky you couldn't see anything.
No, but I always seem to get a bad stomach after that one. I remember Richard Allen's dad, Doc Allen, telling us, yeah, just drink a can of Coke. That's why I always tell Richard. It never seemed to work for him either, though.
Yeah, I always tell everyone that too. I don't know if it's true or not, but we always do that still. And I get my kids doing that. But, I never got sick actually after Iron Bridge.
No.
I probably wasn't in as long as you though.
I wasn't in that long. Swimming's always been one of my better hands. But
that's true.
So you raced quite a bit internationally as well. Do you remember the first international race you did? And would that have been a representing GB race?
I guess it might have been. I mean, the first one, again, that really stands out was Avignon, but, you know, the first World Championships.
Is that the one where Glenn probably, was second?
Yeah, and it was the first ever World Championships. Mm. So, and I remember I must have been pretty new onto the team. You know, and obviously everything was off a really low budget. I mean, I think we had to pay most of it ourselves, and you know, we travelled down, you know, by train, sleeping, you know, over on an overnight train, and but it was an amazing race that, that's definitely first experience of that kind of race. Yeah, no, it was something very special about that race too.
I've had both Glenn and Mark Allen, who won that event, and of course that was the precursor to that run of form he had, because Mark Allen went to Avignon, having trained for that standard distance race, went back to America, and a few months later won his first Hawaii. So they've both been on the podcast and both talked fondly about that event.
Yeah, did they tell you about how much too long the swim was, though?
I'll have to go back and listen. I'm sure somebody mentioned it.
Yeah, I don't. Something happened. I don't know what it was in the swim, but like the first people were out of the swim in like 30 minutes. So it obviously had a massive bearing on the result. You know, Suti Glenn and a few other people. I think they were expecting there to be a current, but the current had been shut off or something. You know, like it was dammed. So the swim was a bit of a muck up, and I remember being a long way down coming out of the swim.
Yeah, and I guess once you elevate yourself up to that sort of top level of competition, there was a few other Uber bikers that were in that field, so it wasn't just you.
Yeah, no, there were then, you know, and I can't even think who would have been, but the people like Mike Pickers and there was a couple of, you know, guys biking really fast at the time, weren't there?
I wonder if Hal Regal would have been would he have been racing short distance then as well?
No, I think he was a little bit after that, just a little bit. I can't say for sure. He might have been there. I don't think he was there.
Okay, so I'm getting from that then that in the UK, Ironbridge was probably your favourite race. What were your favourite races that you've had the opportunity to do?
I mean, one of my favourite races, and again, it's one that I always did well in. It was right at the last race of the year, and it was really late. It was a lat in Israel, and that always had some good people racing. But it was like a December race. And it was the end of a couple of times. I think it was the end of the European series as well. But it just suited me. It was a hard, windy, kind of uphill slog bike. But I think I won that a few times. And, you know, in the day, I'd actually won some what was fairly good money then at that race. And it was just a nice, because then it was like you're there for a week and you did the race and you had time to relax and kind of just enjoy the time afterwards.
I remember a lat. I went on a training camp there with an old friend of yours, Bernie Shrewsbury. Yeah. And I think Bernie did the race. Dave Scott was there as well. I think you did it. And I remember doing the race, and you ride out of town. It's, as you say, it's an uphill slog into the wind. But then I do recall that when you turned around and came back down to town, you got this tailwind. So it was like running out of gears.
Yeah, I was derived like a 56.11 or something coming back down there. I think that was the year Dave Scott. I think that's the year, one of the years I won it actually, because I think so. To check that, I might have won it that year you were there.
1989, I'm sure it was. Who was your? We've talked about a few of your main competitors. Do you recall who the most significant ones were at that time in the UK and abroad?
I think in the UK, when things were going really kind of well for me, was like Glenn. So this Mark Malabini, Robin, Bernie Shrewsbury. And then there was also people like, I guess, Rick Kiddle and John Ashby and Ricky Morris? Remember Ricky?
Yeah, Rick Morris from Wales, I think. Was he the guy that had the Mohican?
Yeah. So I mean, those are kind of the names I think of. Who else was there?
Jack have been amongst
Harris.
Jack Maitland.
Jack would have been racing. I don't take this the wrong way, but I never saw Jack as kind of a threat in a way. I don't know why. I think he was kind of a weaker, slightly weaker swimmer biker. So. You know, I think, you know, at the time it was, you know, Glenn was really the one you know, I was trying to beat. But then, you know, what happened then soon after that, you got like Spencer Smith and Simon Lessing coming along. And they kind of almost demoted us all to a slightly, you know, second tier. You know, in reality is what happened. I mean, they just took everything to a new level, really.
Yeah. But you did move up. You did Ironbridge, so you were clearly pretty well suited to the half iron distance. But you did pretty well at iron distance as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know one of your questions is what I preferred. You know, Olympic distance was my favourite, but I was probably best at middle distance. You know, and the problem is as the sport developed and there was, you know, the drafting kind of became a bit of a factor and. Was if not legal, it was influencing races. That's why I then went to long distance, but it never really suited me. You know, it was swimming, biking was okay, but I was never an efficient, light enough runner to ever do really well. It's just so hard, isn't it? You know, to be able to run off a hard long bike. You know, it suits a certain type of person that. You know, just outside the top, I think I finished 20th and 21st or something in Hawaii. back in the day, but Hawaii never really. It's a hard race. I think my best, I finished a fourth in Ironman in Denmark. I think I finished fourth. Whether it was right. An Ironman branded, I can't remember now.
Frederica, would it have been?
Yeah. So yeah. Peter Sandvang and Peter Sandvang won it. Peter Kropko was third.
Yeah.
And Morten Finger.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Morten Finger was second.
Right.
So
I remember the names. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, Peter Sandvang, you know, was three times world long distance champion.
I mentioned briefly the Captain Quads nickname, and I guess, you know, when you're talking about being an efficient runner, you did have a huge pair of quads, Richard, and that propelled you to some amazing bike times. But I guess the downside of that is that you then had to persuade those quads to get you through through the run section.
I had to drag them around. It was a shame I couldn't, like, just kind of clip them off and somehow. And I guess they didn't help me too much on the run, but it's quite funny. And actually, you talk about Bernie. It's Bernie. He's the one who gave me that name, and Bernie gave everybody nicknames.
Right.
So mine was Captain Quads. I mean, I can't remember what his other names he gave. Robin Drew was, what was he? What did he call Robin? I can't remember now. But he gave us all nicknames. It must be a forces thing.
Yeah, I'll have to send him a message and see if we can get them up on the Facebook page.
Yeah, Winnie the Pooh was Robin's.
Yeah, slight bit of a tangent there, but I can see how you could work something out of that. Were your thigh muscles entirely natural, Richard, or did they require a fair amount of leg work in the gym?
No, I didn't do any gym work, but a tiny amount. So yeah, it came from biking, really. I mean, it just, you know, and it's, you know, as I say, I started really late. So, you know, maybe if I'd started a bit earlier, that I could have been a good biker. I don't know.
I think most people would say you were a good biker, Richard.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for that.
We talked about you being a full-time pro. Yeah, I mean, I had Elliot Smales on, who's one of the up-and-coming 70.3 athletes based in Leeds here. He's won a few 70.3 Ironman events. And we were talking about the money in sport. There isn't a great deal these days unless you're right at the very top. What was it like when you were around?
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one, really, because I think in some ways, you know, there was okay money because there was only a few of us,
right,
as far as prize money, there was only a few of us kind of getting it. You know, and I remember there being like a 220 series where first prize was £1,000. Which it's not a lot of money, but you know, if there was like six or seven of those races a year, and you could almost guarantee you were going to come like first or second, you know, it added up. And it, you know, I was mortgage free because I was living with my parents, and you know, it's not like living a life of luxury or anything, but it was definitely enough to get by with. Small amount of sponsorship money, but not really a lot. But yeah, the actual prize money, I think, you know, if that's like how many years ago, 30-odd years ago, that was good prize money for, you know, domestic races. I bet you there's not races in the UK, or there's not a series of races offering anything like that, you know, so that was okay. And then the European circuit, that had quite good prize money. So I guess, you know, what we did, we used to race like a lot, you know, we'd almost like race two weekends out of three, just picking up bits of money and getting our expenses covered. And so we were just kind of going around like that, which was kind of nice in a way.
I did a podcast with John Lunt, who ran the Windsor event, which you must have done as well. And John was talking about how when he started that event, but in this same era, John Lilly had put together the 220 series, and that was really the first time there'd ever been any money in triathlon. And I think they did put up some quite good prize purses.
Yeah, no, they did. You know, I mean, it was amazing, really. Yeah.
There's a couple of things I wanted to just pick up on, Richard, but I know you've got to get going. Once you'd finished your career, you were based at Bath, and you were quite instrumental in the start of the original High Performance Centre, weren't you, at Bath University?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, I've been living in Denmark, and I kind of can't remember how it came into being, but the guy, the director of sport there, a guy called Jed, kind of got in contact with me to see if I'd be interested in, you know, coming and coaching. That's kind of how it started, and then it built up from that. And, you know, initially I was employed by the university, and then we had, you know, the athletes were coming there, and then Chris Jones was based there. Yeah, and then when I was there for, I think, like 9 years doing that. And it was great, you know, it was a great place. And I think they were at the forefront of you know, setting up these performance centres. And then ones were set up in Leeds and Loughborough and down in Wales. Mm. And actually now I don't even think Bath is one. So it's a bit of a shame, actually.
Well, it may be getting a bit of resurgence because Rhys Davey and Vicky Holland have moved back down there and have got some sort of squad developing. But, I mean, the most of the GB squad that went to the Sydney Olympics were based in Bath, weren't they? Because I know Jody was training down there. Simon Lessing was there. Chris Jones was, as you said, he was working there.
Yeah, I mean, Simon bought a house there. And we had all those guys racing there. You know, Julie
Dibbins,
a long time. Julie, Jody. I mean, Michelle spent some time there. You know, everybody passed through there at some stage. You know, Tim Dons and all those guys, which was lovely. It was a good time actually.
What are you doing now, Richard? I know we mentioned that you're in France. How much coaching are you doing?
So I still do quite a lot of, you know, online coaching. I keep a kind of a group of about 20 people. I run quite a few camps in Lanzarote, which I still enjoy. So that's my kind of winter getaway. We go to Club of Santa still a lot. I've got 9 weeks there this winter, which is great. And then, you know, our place in France, which I was, you know, as I think said before, you know, when we're offline, and our place here in France started out with the plan of being like a triathlon centre. But actually, it's turned into a family holiday resort where we just look after families who've got relatively young kids, up to about the age of 12, really. They come here and just enjoy kind of, and it, you know, it's lovely because it's actually enjoying being kids in a way. Without their electronics a lot often, you know, we've got a nice school. And so, yeah, it's nice summers because we kind of offer swim teaching and all kinds of bits and pieces like that. Very little triathlon work here, which is nice. It's a nice balance actually between coaching I can do anywhere by online, you know, Lanzarote. I still do my own racing. Yeah, and then we got the place here, so it's quite diverse really. So I've got to fix everything that breaks as well. So there you go.
Yeah, it's not quite the romantic thing of just living somewhere where you can train, is it? You've got to clean the drains and unblock the toilets when they get blocked as well.
Yeah, and that is quite often. And the amount of things you make is unbelievable, you know. Anyway, don't get me started.
Well, look, I know you've got to dash off. Just quickly, just let people know where they can find you. Tell us, the base you have is called Try Living, right?
Yeah, so my coaching and camps are, you know, on a site, tryliving.co.uk. And then our place in France, which is still a nice place to come and train if anyone ever wants to, is the website is livingfrance.org. So those are two good, you know, links. And, you know, and we still have people come out here and we can organise some nice training close by. Why we came here really, it's just quiet. I mean, I know it's probably one of your questions is why we came to France, but it's just, you know, we can ride for an hour and see nobody, literally nobody. And it's just a nice way to be.
Where's the nearest airport to you then?
People fly to Bordeaux or La Rochelle. So Bordeaux is about an hour 40 away and La Rochelle's an hour away. La Rochelle only kind of operates mainly in the summertime, so we use Bordeaux a lot. To get to, there's another one called Poitiers, but I don't think that has so many flights anymore. But now Bordeaux is great. Lots of flight, EasyJet now fly most places.
Okay, well, I know you've got some links for your training camps as well, so we'll put all of those onto the show notes along with the Try Living and the Live in France. I'll see if I can get an old photograph from somewhere of those fantastic quads that we talked about. And
yeah. If you're struggling, let me know. I can find one, I'm sure.
Well, I probably need a photograph to promote the podcast anyway, but we can talk about that afterwards. Listen, Richard, it's been great catching up. Thanks very much for agreeing to come on the show. It's been great to chat with another one of the people who really are part of the tapestry of what British triathlon is now. And I mean, we are amongst one of the most powerful triathlon nations in the world at the moment. And you guys were there at the forefront of it. So, you know, thanks for being there and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, I feel I was really lucky that I was in part of the sport while, you know, in its infancy, and it's a sport that suited me at the time because, you know, being a strong biker, I don't think I'd have had anywhere near the same sort of success because biking, especially in the shorter distance, I feel, you know, really lucky that I lived it then when it was the sport as it was then.
Yeah. All right, Rich. Well, thanks very much for being on the show. Appreciate your time and good luck for the coming season if you're racing.
Thanks a lot, Simon. It's really great talking to you.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe you'd be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.